You are listening to the Salty Witches podcast and you're watching it on YouTube. We are coming from a different place, the void.
Yes, we are in the void.
We are in the void right now. We almost thought about doing a virtual background, but then I would just be get lost. But see, if I do this, I disappear anyway.
Where'd you go?
I'm right here.
Oh my God, scary.
So we have some listener questions tonight. We're gonna do our best to get through those.
I'm really loving that we're getting all the listener questions.
Me too. I love them. It makes our job easier.
That certainly is true. But also, I like it because that it helps us to make sure that we're actually really putting information out there that is
good,
relevant.
Yeah.
To you, to our lovely saltines.
Exactly. So we're gonna go through some listener questions real quick, and then the podcast suggestion. And subject tonight is Italian folk magic.
Yes, we're going to discuss that a bit. Yes.
So let's start with Jack's because my questions are a little bit.
Well, Jack's questions kind of have been sitting for about 3 weeks now. So let's not delay. So, and again, Jack was a guest on the podcast a few weeks back.
Songs and Sorcery.
So yes, and do check out Jack's podcast, Songs and Sorcery, on YouTube. It's always a good time. And Jack has a really interesting voice, I think, when you look at, I'm not talking the fact that he's musical and he sings, because he does do that as well, but I'm just mean like the things that Jack presents or talks about as it would relate to kind of the transition from like religion into occultism. Like, I think that that's always a perspective I think that people need to like hear.
I agree.
Anyway, so, all right. So, hey guys, started thinking of some questions that may cause some problems or potential benefits from the spirits. They say, I'm getting into the experimental phase, possibly uncharted territory. I love experimentation.
Me too.
In magic specifically. Although in other things as well.
College.
College. Yeah, that's what we'll call it. College. Is it still college when it happens off campus?
Yes. Move forward. Let's go.
I think experimentation is a really important component of spiritual
practice. Most definitely, especially in your magical
practice. Well, and I think so many people are afraid of that too.
Yeah, they're afraid of doing it wrong.
They're like, if I don't do this thing exactly as I read it from this book or off of this website, then like the whole world could explode.
Yeah.
You know, and that like is never going to happen. So yeah. Anyway, but Jack's getting experimental. Love to hear that. Question one, if possible, how would one go about siphoning energy or power from a god or element? So we're getting into what I would probably identify as kind of something more within the realm of like necromantic kind of work here. And to be honest, you know, in looking at siphoning energy from a spirit like that, I'm trying to figure out where to start with this. But the first thing I'm going to probably say is that you need to, of course, tread very carefully. You know, if you are dealing with a spirit like a god, you're obviously dealing with a spirit, even an elemental. You're dealing with spirits that do have the potential, like they've got the power to really cause you trouble. You know, and so you need to be really careful about that. I would probably say that it would be good, particularly in dealing with deity, it would be really good to do some pretty elaborate ritual and offering for probably a prolonged amount of time before you try to take anything.
Most definitely.
And you'll want to make sure that you have some sort of conversation with that spirit about that.
Prior to the ritual working as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't want to find yourself on the end of a situation where you have taken something and in the process you have now angered a spirit that has the ability to harm you. And that would be true for either deities or elemental beings.
Yeah.
It's important to remember, I think a lot of people have this idea, there are some traditions out there that kind of teach that your energy is finite or that spiritual energy is finite. You know, and with, you know, just kind of talking about the idea of energy transfer, I'd want to again kind of say that that is not true at all. Well, that energy is not finite.
Well, energy cannot be created or destroyed. So
really, it always just changes form.
It just
right?
changes form.
So to potentially to take energy from something like a deity, I think, you know, as long as you've gotten the permission for that, I don't think that a deity is really going to be too bothered about something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there would be some that would be more willing to do that for you than others. But I also think a lot of that's going to have to do with what you're planning on doing with that energy.
Agreed.
You know, like if you're going to appeal to a deity who is primarily associated with peace and love and balance in things, and you're going to use their energy to do some sort of awful shit, like try to enact like a horrible conflict or a war somewhere in the world, right? Like that deity is probably going to be like, fuck you, no.
Yeah.
You know, so so those are things to consider. But I don't know. We've talked about necromancy on the podcast, but I don't think that we've actually ever really gone into or we've elaborated on the actual processes ritually and physically to actually drain or to take energy from other living things.
Yeah, we've never really talked about that because when we did the podcast episode on necromancy,
yeah,
it was with someone who didn't know what they were doing.
Well, no, we don't need to go there. Okay. That is true. But but what I wanted to say is the reason I have not, as we talked about necromancy in the past, the reason I have not kind of gone that route is I'm never entirely sure who's going to see this.
Yeah.
Who's going to have access to this information. And I don't want to send some like angsty 13-year-old edgelord out there in the world, you know, off with information on how to necromantically drain energy and then find out that they have used that on like, oh God, who knows, right? So I'm not going to go there.
But Mike is teaching a necromancy 101 class.
I am, but I don't think that class is one available online too. I'm probably not going to be going into that because it is an introductory class.
Okay.
So again, Jack asks, how would they go about doing this? In the most general sense, you're going to need to ritualistically set up some sort of vessel or something to serve as a temporary transfer point from the energy that you are absorbing into then like that then becomes you.
Yeah.
Right. And you again in the process of doing this ritualistically or ceremonially, I would actually say it would be beneficial to structure some component of that working around an item that you actually have to take into yourself. Something that you could drink, something that you could eat. There are lots of things. I know that that's actually one of those, there's this idea and I think it's one of those things that kind of stems from like the old puritanical views on like the colonial puritanical views and like some of the old Protestants, I'm rambling, views on how witches are imbued with kind of like the devil's power. Right, the idea is like will they have sex with the devil?
Yeah,
right, you know, and somehow being penetrated by the devil is something that like imbues the witch with infernal or diabolical power.
Yeah,
right, that's one of the things that pops up here and there, and which is of course, you know, not true necessarily. Though there are spirits that you can work with in that capacity. Anyway, that would be one of the other, I'd say, just mechanical components I would say to add to this. Like, okay, you need something to actually like hold that energy to be a focus for the energy that you then take into yourself. So that's really kind of all I want to volunteer on that as far as the hows. You know, Jack, if you've got questions on that, you always know how to contact us privately. Yeah. We can kind of give you maybe a few more pointers. If I know you personally are utilizing the information, I'm probably okay with that, but not such a public sphere.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. Oh, he goes on to say, like, are there some gods that wouldn't mind? Do you want to volunteer that? Can you think of some deities that probably would be okay with something like this? As long as the purpose was good, right?
Hecate.
Okay. You want to maybe elaborate on why?
Well, Hecate is a goddess of agency, sovereignty, and Hecate is vast. And any deity that's going to deal in the realm of liminality, I'm sure is going to be really good to work with on that, just because, oh, hi, Roxy. Yes. Sorry, my nose is running like a sieve.
Like a sieve?
Like a sieve. And it's going to be really good. Gods of death, necromantic gods, gods that would be vampiric in nature, they're going to be okay with this. You probably want to avoid gods that are going to be centered around life-giving properties, unless you're working it in a particular manner that's used to heal.
I'm so sorry. Okay.
So that's my two cents.
Okay. even then, though, I'm thinking about this, and I was like, you wouldn't need to drain energy from the god to do something like that. You basically just ask them to utilize their own energy toward that benefit or spirit. I'm just kind of thinking of, again, about kind of like just the logistics behind Jack's initial question. So anyway,
yeah,
okay. Are we ready to move on?
Yeah.
Okay, question two. Thinking about casting a spell on themselves, utilizing cosmic energy or that of gods to enable certain benefits, maybe even awaken something dormant or maybe something repressed for some introspection and healing, and tweak it a bit for various other workings. Is there a way you'd recommend to go about this? Would you advise this? I think that component is really, like, that would seem to me like that's a pretty common thing. I think as magical practitioners, it's common for us to imbue ourselves with the energies or the attributes of other things. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, that's what a full moon ritual is.
Yeah.
You're working with the energy of a full moon or the energy or the spell of a full moon to manifest something. And if you get deeper into the planetary alignments, you know, full moon in Pisces, you could utilize that energy for dream work. You could utilize that energy for psychic work and deep healing and things like that. So I think it's completely and totally possible to do that. And as a matter of fact, I'd venture to say that most magical applications are just that, you know, individuals who follow things like the celestial bodies, the stars and stuff like that, you're going to be imbuing yourself and the working with that.
Okay, cool. All right. Ways to go about doing this. The only advice I would really have to this, because really, again, you're looking at the way that you would magically involve pulling energy into yourself. I guess you'd have to look at the way that you were doing that. You know, like if you wanted to imbue yourself with, say, like fire, for instance, right? Like you really, you know, like obviously you don't want to, like, you know, put your hand in an open flame, right? Mm-hmm. Not a good idea. But, you know, say like getting up close to a fire, right? Not to the point that you're actually burning, right? But where you can feel the heat, that intense heat, you know, almost to the point where it is uncomfortable. Like that would be kind of an ideal way to kind of incorporate or to kind of pull that energy in, right? We're exposed and we have energies that move through us all the time, you know, sunlight for one, right? We're always exposed to sunlight.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter even at nighttime, we're still exposed to sunlight. You know, starlight, moonlight, whatever it may be, right? We are exposed to all kinds of different radiations all the time, you know, everything that moves through the light spectrum, right? It's very much how the world works. And, you know, so I think that it would be good for you in looking at doing this, particularly since you mentioned that you're looking at this for like introspection and healing. I think it would be good for you to do some research into the particular kinds of energies or the alignments and correspondences that would have those associations. You know, if you're looking at healing, I would say it would be good for you to focus on connecting to energies that, you know, have associations with healing.
Agreed.
Water is always a really good one for that, you know,
or how the different energies heal.
Yeah, exactly. That's true, because you can heal with fire. Absolutely. Right. You can heal with pretty much anything. You just have to work with it in the right capacity. But that would be my only other kind of tidbit or advice. Oh, well, hello, miss.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, good.
There's a Roxy blue.
Oh, hi.
And a camera. Okay. Three, can a familiar find you or do they have to be called/looked for?
Yes. I will say that in my Awakening the Witch class, this is something that we talk about quite frequently. There's a difference between familiars and spirit guides, though a familiar is a type of spirit guide. There are some familiars that are just kind of lingering around you, or spirits have taken a liking to you. And once issued the invitation to step forward and assist you, that is there. But as a witch, as someone who has agency, a sovereign, and is controlling their own path, controlling their own fate, their own power, it's just like the belief in deities. Very rarely is a deity going to step up and be like, you're mine. You're most of the time going to be seeking and searching them out, sending that flare out, putting that radar beep out there, and those things are going to come.
Okay.
Is that good?
Yeah, you're good. I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's all I have from Jazz.
Okay.
All right, so moving on.
So, do you have others?
No, you're good.
Okay. So, this one is anonymous, an Arizona saltine. Arizona Saltine.
Sure. Okay.
Hello, I remember a couple of episodes featured music breaks, and I know they had to be abandoned due to copyright issues. One that made it into my playlist was Ache by Math Bonus, which is a good song.
I love Math Bonus.
Would you be able to mention a few more artists or playlists for us to look into? Oh, so much. It all is going to depend. I really like working. I love Chevron. Is it Chevron? Chevron or VRN?
What? Oh, Churn.
Churn, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, but it's Churn, but it's C-H. They spell their name with a V.
Yeah.
So it's C-H-V-R-N.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Churn is always a really good
one. Yeah, so anything by Churn is going to be really good.
What's that? What's the other one? She's like really popular lately. Her name's Kiki. And she sings a lot about like witches and like women's empowerment and, you know, like taking back power from the false Christian God. And oh my gosh, the last thing Churchill are, where is my thing? Here, I'm trying to like pull up the things. I'm pulling up my list just because I got suggestions.
I will also pull up my playlist.
So I like, where are you? There we go.
I like Trance Ritual. It's a playlist that you can find on Spotify, created by Devin Hunter. It's actually pretty good. Diana, Queen of Witches, is actually a playlist that I and a few others have created, which has a lot of really good, music in it. Modern Witch Caviar, again, by Devin Hunter, is pretty good. You're going to find a lot of modern day pagan stuff on there. Music for the Devil is actually a Jimmy Gary album. And it's by Morvoren. And it's, you have to find it other places because it's not available on Spotify. I have mine on Spotify because of technology. Let's see.
The name I was thinking of was Kiki Rockwell.
Okay.
Pretty much every song I've heard from Kiki Rockwell has been like a big, like, women's empowerment, like, fuck the patriarchy, you know, like, the world is in shambles, let's take back our witch power and fix it.
Yeah.
You know, I love that. I was also going to say, let's see, I'm looking at a few others.
I love Diaboli by Daniel Messina and John Weschel.
If you like Math Bonus, you might like Mild Minds.
Carlene. I like Carlene. Yeah, Carlene's as well.
A good one too.
Yeah.
Curly did that album. What was it like? Tula Toy?
I have no idea.
Like that. Curly, K-E-R-L-I. She did like a whole album a few years back that was all like very like goth witch.
Yeah.
And she's like a techno pop kind of an artist. Yeah. But she like, there were some really cool vocals and things on that album.
Yeah.
Every album she releases is like got a very different sound. She's kind of very
Trobar de Muerte is also really good.
Otiken is one I've been listening to.
I love Otiken.
And that's O-T-Y-K-E-N. And they are an indigenous Siberian group that mixes like traditional songs from their culture with like techno kinds of music.
I have a playlist. I don't know if it's public, but I actually call it Working a Mill. Mm. And they're all really good. Sometimes you might feel like you're the Lilith Fair. But like it's one of my favorites is Glashed and Shanty by S.J. Tucker. Just something about the beat and kind of the rhythm that goes with it is actually pretty cool.
Okay.
Boudica by Carlene. I like Witch's Rune by S.J. Tucker.
I think it's pronounced Boudicca.
It's Boudica.
I think it's pronounced. So I think it's supposed to be pronounced Boudicca.
Except for Boudica is a Celtic
priestess. Oh, I know. I know,
and yeah, but I think, Caesar, I think Yeah, but otherwise, it'd be
but Celtic. I think that's how it was originally spelled. And she actually, she wasn't Celtic, if I remember correctly. I think she was Pictish.
Okay. Well, sorry. Either way. So that's a really good one. Blood and Bone by Omnia, I really like.
Omnia in general is another good, yeah. Good, just a good group.
Earth to Earth by Incubus Succubus is really good. It's really good for healing, actually. You could also use it for Baneful work as well.
I also wanted to throw out
Wingovia. Yes.
Oh, gross. I love, like, if you like, again, more world kind of music, like, but like with a good rhythm. I love Beats Antique. And Beats Antique is like, they're a group that's been around for a really long time. And most people associate their music with the belly dance community.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have some tracks that are like really quite good for, I think, witchcraft.
Roxy is concerned about me.
She was worried about me. That's so sad. I'm sorry she's concerned about you. One of the things I've really been listening to a lot lately, and I put a playlist together for it called Women Who Kill. And I don't mean like they're killing people, but who knows? I really find a lot of the older music. When I say older, I mean like my generation older. I like a lot of the music from like the 90s.
Yeah.
But it was like the women alternative singers, you know, like you had like, of course, Ms. Morissette, who blew the door.
I do love Ms. Morissette.
But there were so many that came out. I mean, I'm looking at my list now, like Ruby, and so many people are not at all familiar with Ruby. And I don't know why, because she's amazing. And her album, her album was called Saltpeter. I think when it came out, it was called Saltpeter. And it was, again, kind of very much a like, I'm a very powerful alternative woman, and maybe, yeah, I practice a little bit of witchcraft. So fuck with me.
Surprisingly enough, a lot of classical music is going to be really good. Mm-hmm. If you want to work with planetary energies, the Planetary Suites by Holtz is really awesome. Yep. I actually did an experiment with Mia, one of the readers in our shop, where I put that on and I shuffled it. And I had Mia guess, like, what planet is this? And she guessed it every time. It really does capture the energy of the planet. Like the Jupiter one is like growth and expansion and jovial. And it just has that feel. So that would be really, really good. looking at stuff like that. Let's see. They had another question as well. Would you be able to mention a few more artists or playlists to look into separately? Do you find that music is helpful to enter meditative states, or is it more advisable to cultivate the skill in silence? It is all depending on the person. I love music when I meditate, but it all depends on what I'm doing, what I'm trying to focus on. I find that if I'm trying to meditate, I really like underwater sounds, not like rain or thunder or anything like that, though those are nice, but like the sounds of like being underwater is really cool. I actually did a ritual at the shop where I played Sounds of the Womb, and so it just kind of repeated, and it was a baby in the womb. I like turned the temperature up in the classroom space.
Okay, yeah.
So we were like in the womb. So it was actually really pretty cool. It can be very helpful. I will say that you want to listen to something all the way through before deciding, like, oh yeah, this is really great, because you can listen to something and like the first few minutes you're like, oh yeah, this is cool. And then it ends and you're like, that was anticlimactic. So that is all, music is so personal. I've raised some kick-ass energy to the Queen of the Night aria, the Dehode Racha. So I, you know, it's all going to be very personal for you. Dance music, electronic dance music is also really good.
For raising power,
yeah. So, All right. Next listener question. Thank you for that question. That was good. I love music.
Clearly, you like went on for like 20 minutes there. I don't think I've ever. It's been a minute since you contributed that much to a podcast. Thank you. Like, this burden has been shifted. Damn. I'm sorry. Go on. We had another question.
I don't care if you use my name. Cool. Hi.
Then don't.
This is Carlos from Michigan.
Show you.
Again, As quoted before, I'm very much...
Carlos. We like Carlos. Yes. Carlos is always good.
Yes. Again, as quoted before, I'm very much new, doing this alone 7 months. I'm opening myself up to all experiences until I find my own path. I have heard rumors and words through the air that you are either born a witch or not, that this is an innate skill, not a taught one, either born with a gift or not. What are your views on the average Joe getting involved in the craft? Right now, all I'm doing is reading and meditating. I learned about chakra energy flow elements, and that's where I am right now. And secondly, the second question is about tarot cards. So we'll start with the first one.
That's bullshit. I'm just going to say that right now. That idea that someone must be born carrying the witch blood, as many myths and legends and lore, you know, out there may exist around that. We understand in a modern context, particularly with the ability to now go back and look at many of the cultures and the societies that would have had people in them that would, in modern terms, be identified as witches. Because remember, in years past, which being a witch wasn't a thing, right? At least not something you actively would have called yourself, right? That would have been death.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all just rooted in white supremacy. This idea that like you have special blood, or that you're born to the right people, or that you're whatever, like that is the definition of white supremacy.
I will say that I firmly believe that not everyone can be a witch.
But that had, okay, so elaborate on that though, because
I am, that I was going to.
Okay, please. Yes.
That, because it has more to do with the work that's involved in being a witch. Anyone can go to a store, get a chime candle and light it, say some flowery words and say, I cast a spell. That does not a witch make. A witch holds a different set, higher set of morals and ethics, does what they can to assist the world and those in need around them in their community. And I'm not just talking the witchcraft community and the pagan community. I'm talking about the community as a whole, all around. That is just part of what makes a witch. I do believe that there are some people who are born with innate skills in witchcraft, and it might be
one of your demons has gotten loose.
It's Roxy. She's beating up Scout because he stole her toy. I do believe that there are some people who are born with that innate sense. Like they're born into a family of witches and that just kind of like goes, but it is still up to that person to pick up the witchcraft, follow that tradition and move forward. Do I think that someone is born a witch? No. Do I believe that there is an ability to be born into a family of practitioners of witches and that can potentially give you an upper hand? Yes.
Okay. I would agree.
But it has nothing to do with the blood. It has everything to do with the spirit.
It is. It's the spirit. And as you mentioned, beyond that, it's the commitment and the dedication.
Exactly.
The discipline to the work. Because witchcraft is work.
It is a lot of work.
If you're doing it right, it's going to be work.
It's true.
It's going to be, there are going to be painful moments. There are going to be scary moments.
There are going to be cool moments.
A lot of cool moments. Totally. Carlos had other questions.
Yes. Carlos had another question. I'm going to go ahead and pause this.
Oh, are you going to kill the dogs?
I'm not going to kill the dogs, but I am going to let them out because Roxy has the zoomy poops.
Oh. Like in the middle.
Okay, so here. I have cast out the demons. You have a pretty light over there. I've cast out the demons. So we're going to move on to Carlos's next question. So hopefully that answered your question, Carlos, when it comes to that. If you're willing to put in the work, you can call yourself a witch. Okay. You just got to do the work. It's a lot of hard work. Very rewarding. All right. Where did it go? Are tarot cards drawn different to represent different readings, or are they drawn different for theme and preference? They all have the coin or pinnacle for earth, the sword or athame for air, the staff or wand for fire, the cups or chalice for water. I haven't seen many tarot cards, so I can't speak proficiently on the subject, but do they all have the same other cards as well, such as death? I bought a nice deck myself. It's a nice color.
And it's a nice color at yourself deck. Bought it at Universal Studios. It's Halloween themed. Can I use these? So first, yes, you can use those. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. A lot of people don't understand, and I still get this question a lot. What's the difference between tarot and oracle? So tarot cards is a specific system. Okay. It is the system of tarot, which is based in either the Rider-Waite-Smith, or the Crowley, the Thoth stuff. And neither is correct, neither is wrong. They're all going to be just a little bit different. There are certain things in the Crowley system that I'm like, okay, that makes more sense. Like justice and strength being switched. I prefer strength to be first to justice, whereas justice and strength are switched in the right way, I do believe. So all tarot cards, in order for a deck to be considered tarot, it is your major arcana, which is the full, which is zero, all the way through to 22, which is the world. Am I right?
Well, it's 21.
21. 21, okay. Which is the world. Okay, so it's 21 archetypes there. Then you have the different courts, like you mentioned, which will all have kings, queens, pages, and knights in them, and aces. Sometimes those names are going to flip. It's still going to be considered a tarot card, though, or a tarot deck because of the court. You know, so you have your courts, you have your pips, and you have your stuff like that. So that is what makes tarot a tarot. Oracle cards are all going to be based in the author, the illustrator or the artist. It's all going to be based on that. They're all going to be different themes. So, you know, the Seasons of the Witch Samhain Oracle is not going to be the same as the Anatomy of the Witch Oracle. They're going to be different. You'll still read them very similarly just because Oracle cards, you kind of pull one or a couple out at a time, but they don't really have like a major arcana, minor arcana, stuff like that. However, there are Oracle cards that do have that, but then that is a completely different system. Then you have your Lenormand and your Kipper, and your Lenormand and your Kipper decks are based off of traditional cardomancy and like cards, like playing cards. Am I right? Am I in the area?
Yeah, you know, you're doing good. You're doing good.
So that is what the difference between tarot, oracle, all that stuff is. Yeah, you can use the deck you got. You just want to make sure that it has all the cards. You want to make sure that it has, you know, aces, ace through 10 on in the pips. And then you want to make sure it has all the court cards, and you want to make sure it has all the major arcana.
Yes, and it should be the average deck is 78 cards.
Yes. Now there are decks that are considered tarot but are non-traditional tarot, one of which is like the Dreams of Gaia tarot. The Dreams of Gaia tarot follows the suit structure, but I think it has like extra, I think it has some extra major arcana. And the
which one is this?
The Dreams of Gaia tarot.
Oh yeah, that is not at all a traditional tarot deck.
Yeah, it's non-traditional.
Which is fine.
Yeah, so there are some tarot cards that would be considered non-traditional, like the Dreams of Gaia tarot, which is a beautiful deck. But if you're used to reading a traditional tarot card and you pull that, it's hard to fucking read with that deck. It's really hard to read with the Dreams of Gaia deck if all you do is just read tarot. Then there's also, I think it's Fabio Lestrani, the Tarot in Darkness and Tarot in Light, the Goetia and the Seraphim, or the Goetia and the Angels. Those are also really hard to read with because they don't follow that structure. They're pretty though, and they're great for workings.
Yeah.
So
there are so many tarot decks out there now, and as the years have progressed, people have kind of gotten steadily more creative with the structure of the tarot, mm-hmm. as they've gone, which is not a bad thing.
No, it's not.
You know, the tarot has actually always kind of been one of those tools where it's always kind of evolved.
Yeah.
You know, and to be honest, what we identify as the tarot now really is primarily just based off of A.E. Waite's,
yeah,
kind of structuring of the tarot, which I'll be honest, I don't necessarily like.
Oh, that's
yeah, you heard me, A.E. Waite. You can burn in hell.
We just don't like A.E. Wade.
No, he was a dick.
Yeah.
And he took all the credit for all that work. Pamela Coleman-Smith did all that fucking work on that, on those cards. And, you know, and of course,
she loved him.
She was a woman. I don't know about that, but she was a woman of color in an era where that was, you know, no one's giving you attention for that. Not that that's changed much in the world we live in today. And of course, some rich white douche took credit for all that.
Yeah.
You know, so whatever. Yeah. So E.E. Wade can suck.
Didn't you used to read pretty exclusively with the Thoth deck when you first started?
No, I read with the Thoth deck. It was just kind of one of the few decks that I worked with. But I ultimately kind of retired my Thoth deck because I got to a point where I was like, I'm never going to be able to utilize this deck to its fullest because I had no interest in basically becoming a Thelemite.
Yeah.
And it's not that you need to be a Thelemite to read the Thoth deck. Really, you don't. But you do have to cultivate some pretty intense knowledge of Crowley's work.
Yeah.
And I think Crowley is disgusting. I don't like A.E. Wade, and I don't like Crowley. I don't like anybody. If you're a fuddy-duddy old white dude involved with the occult community, get the fuck out of here.
I'm a fuddy-duddy.
You're not, but I am becoming a fuddy-duddy old white man, which means I need to be gearing up to retire soon. You're gonna start doing the podcast all by yourself.
Okay.
Next question.
Podcast. That was it.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah. Right,
okay.
That was it. So you're not even paying attention.
What I am. I'm bringing up discussion points for Italian folk magic.
Okay,
sir.
So on to Italian folk magic,
and you'll have some stuff to discuss.
Will I?
Ooh, it is my spooky lamp. Okay. You can see like right up the nose of that mask. It's kind of funny. It looks like a pig. Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about Italian folk magic. I can't remember what was it a couple weeks back. Somebody asked us on this one. So Italian magic, Italian witchcraft, Italian folk magic, whatever you want to call it. You know, and they are technically different things, though they do overlap quite a bit.
Quite a bit.
Is those kinds of spiritual practices are similar to really the same practices that you would find in any other area of the world. And I guess what I mean by that most is that is not, there's no one type of Italian witchcraft or one type of Italian folk magic. There are so many. And so when we utilize a term like Italian witchcraft, what we have to recognize first of all is that is a blanket term for what probably could easily be, you know, a few hundred, several hundred different practices or different traditions, primarily because most of the practice that you're going to find coming from that area of the world is familial in nature.
Most definitely.
And every family from every village, from every area of Italy and Sicily and every other little part of that, you know, the Mediterranean, like every family could and would potentially have a different spiritual
practice. You would do it differently.
You know, and there are certainly things, again, that kind of are common, right? The uses of certain things or particular spirits that would maybe be evoked.
Yeah.
Right. But overall, there's a lot of flexibility and a lot of diversity in those practices. It's kind of one of the things over the years that has always, for me, has always kind of drawn a very strong parallel between Italian traditions and conjure and root work.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we look at conjure and root work and how you work with it, it's lots of ancestral practice. It's rooted in the earth. It's rooted in a focus on healing. It's rooted in a focus on justice, protection, working with the spirits that surround you constantly. Which is, I guess, one of the reasons why my Nona and my Mama got along so well is because of that. And in conjure and root work, it's also familial. You'll have certain things that certain family members do and certain psalms that they'll use for particular things, and you learn how to do that. And you'll talk to another conjure worker and you'll be like, oh yeah, no, I use Psalm 43 for this. And they'll be like, I use Psalm 43 for this. And it was actually really cool because it would bring people together. Now it just tears people apart.
Yeah, it's weird because once upon a time, I think before people were so fucking fragile,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, we used to be able to have a disagreement with somebody and not completely let it ruin our lives, mm-hmm. you know? So yeah, generations past, I think that there was something, I think older generational practitioners were able to find commonality more easily. Now I noticed the last couple generations of really any kind of alternative spiritual practitioner, like they all seem so caught up in trying to prove that their way is the best, or that their way is the only right way,
or that they're the most powerful.
Yeah, you know, and so in the process, when they run across somebody that's like, oh, well, I, you know, I kind of do the same thing, but I do this for this, mm-hmm. you know, instead of going like, oh, that's so fascinating and it's so cool, and using that as an opportunity to one, not only one, learn about what someone else is doing, but to potentially also expand their own practice, because knowledge always makes our own practices bigger, mm-hmm. right? Or our perspective of practice much wider, more complete. They have to use those as like, oh, well, you're wrong. And it's like, you can't tell me I'm wrong because I've been doing this effectively for years and it's working.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Newer generational practitioners, you need to be better. You need to be better.
I mean, I remember my Nona and my Mama like swapping, they call them recipes, but they were work. Mm-hmm. The swapping those things. And my Nona didn't really use camphor until my Mama was like, oh no, here, use this Vicks. It has camphor in it, and camphor helps disperse negative evil spirits.
That's true. Vicks has got some other good stuff in mm-hmm. it too. I mean, it's got, I mean, well, I'm trying to remember, like, yeah, eucalyptus in there. You get rosemary. Was rosemary in there at one point?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so you got some good shit in Vicks. Experiment, y'all. Go get some Vicks and try to incorporate Vicks into your next banishing ritual.
Anoint the candle with a little bit of Vicks. There you go. But it's so interesting because then that became a staple in my Nona's practice. Well, my Mama didn't use rue for a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
but my Nona did. And so when my Nona taught my Mama about like rue mm-hmm. and how its spirit does this, mm-hmm. my Mama started incorporating rue more into her cleansing work.
Oh. Rue's good stuff. And definitely authentic to Mediterranean practice. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a couple of other things to kind of distinguish just really quick, okay? In our area of the world, not just our area of the world, now it's all over the place. Thanks, internet. The term strega, stregiria, and stregoniria, those terms have become really popular in recent years around the explanation of Italian witchcraft and Italian folk magic. And I just want to say, you know, for individual people who want to use those words, they want to use those titles, they want to refer to themselves as a strega, fine. Nothing wrong with that. You know, you do you, right? But those were terms that really, going back historically, those would not have been terms that most people would have willingly applied to themselves.
No.
Those were very...
they were negative.
They were very negative. Like, to have someone refer to you as a strega was like, that was basically like, you're an evil old hag who uses your magic to seduce men and eat children.
Yep.
You know, and so no one was calling themselves a strega. you know, it was a descriptor, certainly, but not a title you ever wanted to have applied to yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so I also want to caution people, you know, using these things is fine, but terms like stregoneria and stregiria, at least as they exist in our area of the world here in the Western Hemisphere, right? These are terms that actually were popularized by eclectic Wiccans, who claimed ancestral lineage to Italy. Okay, but they really have very little to do with the practices coming out of that area of the world.
Yeah.
Right. It's cool sounding packaging, but there's really not a whole lot of substance there.
Yeah. Well, on top of that, if you read Raven Grimassi's stuff,
mm-hmm.
who we love, Raven Grimassi, you know, thank you. Everything that is in Italian witchcraft by Raven Grimassi is Alexandrian Wicca with Italian seasoning and some extra garlic. That's really what it is. And I'm not, I know that sounds bitchy, and I know it sounds like it's watering it down. And there is most definitely.
Well, you've said that on the podcast before.
Yeah. Well, and it is good information. There is some good information in there, but I'm telling you right now, there was no circle casting. There was no calling to the watchtowers of the South. That's just not what that was. And though there were particular things that we would do, it wasn't that.
Word. Other things to talk about. Cultures like Italy's historically are very gender oriented. Yes. And you're going to find those parallels crossing over into their magical practices historically. Men and women historically would have served different roles.
Yes.
As it would relate to the functions that they served as either folk practitioners or witches, right? And even sometimes down to the type of magic that they were allowed to practice, mm-hmm. given the different families and traditions. So you're going to find that a lot of men were going to be responsible for mainly workings around, say, folk healing was a really common thing for men. And that, when I say that, I mean, I should clarify that had, I think, a bit more to do with spiritual evocation and laying on of hands, Taranta kinds of practice, where you're going to find that women were more likely to be your apothecaries. These were your green witches, where they were utilizing herbs and these kinds of things. Not that men didn't work with those things too, mm-hmm. but they were applying them a bit differently in their spiritual work, at least. And these are very generalized things. I want to be very clear. There are so many different types of practice. It's so hard to give you specifics on that would cover everything. But just some generalities. Women predominantly in those cultures were usually the ones, if there was any kind of divinatory work being done, it was almost predominantly women who were doing that work. Mm-hmm. It was really common, and I think, to be honest, even to this day is actually not as common. It is not as likely to go through a popular area of Italy to come across a metaphysical shop. The people doing readings in that shop, they're almost always going to be women. And again, it's just an odd cultural kind of an association with what, which genders are good at what, right? Who knows? We're moving away from a lot of those things, fortunately, but there's still a lot of work to be done. Let's see. I'm reviewing my notes here on this. So most of the practice, and I think this is going to be one that might be not a surprise to a lot of people who see there, hear there, watch this, or our saltines, but most of the practices coming out of this area of the world, when I say practices, I mean your rituals, your spells, these kinds of things, most of that work was going to be ecstatic in nature. Italian folk, we make noise. When we're doing spells and rituals and shit, we make noise. We move our bodies, we make noise, it's kind of like it's a party.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that not only for the living people present, we do that for the spirits that we work with.
Yes.
The spirits that we work with are seen almost as extended family. So when we gather, depending on the nature of the circumstance, the situation, or what's being done, when the family or the village is called in, that includes all of the spirits, because they're also part of the family, part of the village.
Yep.
So ecstatic work, a lot of people, I think, and this is, I think, a problem, and I know you have some thoughts on this too, if you want to share these, but a lot of contemporary practitioners, I think, because they have not been able to successfully move away from religious indoctrination, and because they also are worried about how they'll look or what people will think, it really comes down, I think, to a lot of issues of just like self-perspective or perception and a lack of confidence. But so many practitioners now, people who want to get into witchcraft and folk magic, they go into this stuff with I just quietly sit and focus my intent and charge my candle. And boom, there's my spell. And I'm not trying to say that you can't work a spell that way. Hey, I've done that spell. You can work a spell that way. But a lot of people do that, and then they get to a point where they're like, well, I'm either not feeling what I want to feel from this practice, or I'm really looking for a way to grow, but I don't know what that looks like. That's what it looks like. You have to get up off of your ass You can't just sit and meditate your way through every ritual and spell. You need to move. You need to move your body. You need to put your fucking candle away and use your voice, right? You need to do other things. You need to bring some ecstatic energy into your magic, into your work. That's where the power really is. You'll be amazed how even just getting up and dancing around your workspace, around your altar, even without saying anything, just put some music on it, dance around, you will be amazed at how much more energy you raise toward that spell. So we are ecstatic. We make noise, and we kind of party. We have a good time when we practice. Let's see.
You've ever been to one of the full moon rituals at Cat and Cauldron?
Yeah.
That is...
Yeah, there's dancing. There's a lot of movement. There's singing. We sing a lot. Food is very common.
Yes, food is a big thing.
You know,
stalker.
Yeah, well, right. Manja. Yeah, I mean, yeah, a lot of the witch families in particular were, we would hold like big family gatherings.
Yeah.
You feasts. Know, and there would be like a feast or a family dinner that would be a big component of the celebration.
Yes, and spirits always ate first.
Yeah, and the ritual to be done would be a component of that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. A few different things that you can look into when you look at practices with that would kind of fall into the kind of the realm of what we're talking about here, coming from different areas of Italy. But you have things like beneficaria, which is an interesting one for a lot of people, and it can be hard to find reliable references or resources on this practice. I'll be honest with you, it can be difficult to find reliable resources on a lot of the folk and witch practices coming out of Italy, because the witch families there, the practitioners there,
historically, the church was power, we walked the fuck down.
We have been really closed on a lot of that over the last several centuries.
Why do you think we were so good at the mafia stuff?
You know, and it's odd because in areas of Italy, there's actually a lot of like some overlap between like the mafia,
mm-hmm.
you know, and a lot of the witch families.
Yeah. They come to us to remove the malocchio.
Sometimes.
Anyway. Not sometimes. All the time. We just don't talk about it.
Well, anyway. So it can be hard to find reliable sources on this information. But there's a reason for that, right? I think anybody of you would probably understand that if you are trying to be this, you're trying to practice your folk magic, you're trying to be a witch, and you are basically living right under the shadow of the Vatican, you're going to be really quiet. You're going to be really secretive about what you're doing, right? And that kind of continues to this day. Culturally, in a lot of areas of Italy, it is still like you don't go around to telling people that you practice witchcraft. You don't. I don't really think there's anywhere in the world you can do that. Most places you go at this point, that word and being someone admitting that you are someone who practices witchcraft is still such a charged thing and such a scary thing for people. Doesn't matter like where you go, you're always going to risk, if you put that out loud, you walk into a room with strangers and you say that, every time without fail, there's going to be at least one person in that room that is going to be super freaked out and uncomfortable with that, and potentially even aggressive with you, depending on their spiritual belief. So, and that happens a lot.
Yes, it does.
You know, people were, I mean, just within the last couple of years, I was reading something, people are still being killed in Africa. They find out you're a witch, and in whichever village you're in, that they will kill you.
Most of the time, they just point the finger at the old woman.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very much like that old, like,
or the annoying
idea we had of like the Salem, right? Where you're like, yeah, you don't even really need to be a witch. You just need to be somebody that pisses me off.
Yep.
And I'll just accuse you of being a witch. You know? All right. So, but beneficaria, which is a kind of a cool practice. It is, the way that I explain that is that it is basically like Italian Santeria.
Are you talking about beneficaria or benedicaria?
Benedicaria. Yes.
Yeah. Benedicaria is it's really beautiful and it's big and it's elaborate.
But it involves not only the folk practices of the area, but it incorporates a whole lot of Catholicism.
Yes, it does.
Like working with saints, things like that, which is great. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. You'll have like fattucchieri, which is primarily focused on spirit flight, psychic ability, the development of these things.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the benendante in there.
Yeah, you have the Benedante.
Which is kind of an odd thing because I think that they're, in essence, they're basically just, it's kind of like Benedicaria, but I don't know. They're kind of like, the Benedante are kind of like their own thing.
Yeah. The Benedicaria is very big, ritualistic, and elaborate. And the coin, the term wasn't coined until
the Benedante thing is kind of like a fairly recent kind of thing.
The Benedante is going to be much more like Italian folk Catholic practice.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Whereas Benedicaria is when someone asks you, are you Catholic? Your response is yes. And you go to church every Sunday and this, that, and the other. But it is very interesting because if you look at a Benedicaria altar versus like a Santeria altar, they're going to look very similar.
Yeah.
Lots of glasses of water, lots of statues of saints and angels, lots of Mary.
Yeah.
Lots of Mary. But
we love our Mary.
We do love Mary because it's just Diana.
That is an interesting point I was going to get to in a moment. Yeah. The syncretization or the parallels of deity.
Yes, but then you also have the Maleficari.
So the Maleficari and the Beneficari, this is where I got confused a moment ago. So Beneficari and Maleficari are basically just terms that can be applied to types of magic.
Yes.
But by extension, you can then apply those to people who are more commonly doing or believed to be doing that kind of magic.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll notice the Beneficari or the Benedante, they have that Bene in the front, which is basically just good. Right. So if you are a Benedante or practicing Benedante or you are practicing Beneficaria, the idea is that you are only working good magic, right?
Or Benedicaria.
Which is bullshit because if you're working magic, you're working magic. There's no good or bad. There's only what you do with it. But then we see, you know, the idea of like the evil witches, right? The strega. Right, who primarily practice Maleficari in that they are only interested in sending out the negative, the evil energy, right? The harmful things, right? Which is ridiculous if you think about it, because there's not a witch in the world that would ever intentionally do anything to poison her own land.
True.
Right? We're drawing off that land just like everybody else in town is, right? Why the hell would we want to poison the earth or blight the crops or do God knows what else, right? We're not going to do that. That punishes ourselves, right? These rumors and these old superstitions that the Puritans kind of came up with were really fucking ridiculous. All right, let's see. As I already mentioned, practices were kind of particular to each village or town or area. Mm-hmm. And you have a few throughout Italy, right? You've got our ancestry, we come from the Campania area of Italy primarily. I'm so sorry.
Avellino.
Avellino. You know, but you've got others. You've got the Campania, you've got the Calabria, every area of Italy is going to have different practices, but you're going to find kind of a very strong focus on familial structure as it relates to the practice. You're always going to see this. Well, I won't say always, but you will almost, I would say 99% of the time, you're going to see younger people moving into these kinds of spiritual practices. You're going to see them always kind of giving deference or referring to the elders, right? Within the practice or kind of within the community, you know, nobody goes against what great Nona, whatever says.
Right? No, you do not go against Bisnona.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. If Bisnona says something, you listen. You don't go against what she says. And if you do, you know, there's going to probably be trouble and not from her, but from the spirits, so there's this focus on, again, much as we see respect for the ancestors, we see, again, kind of more of a focus toward respect for our physical, our living elders, and understanding that they also are seen as kind of the pioneers, right? The people who carried those practices before you did.
Well, on top of that, we believe that once they die, the path that they laid, we walk and we build upon that path. So we keep them strong, we keep them honored, and we keep them healthy, and we respect them, then that bridge, that path that they have built is going to be much more sturdy for us.
Yeah. We're back. We had to take a quick break. Management needed to be let in after having gone outside to potty. So some interesting things to kind of share, just some extra tidbits as we kind of wind down our talk on Italian magic and witchcraft. some things that a lot of people, I think, find interesting if they look at the lore. But a lot of the families throughout Italy historically that were seen to have, not just families, I guess I should say, but communities where you had thriving folk magical practices, or where you found groups of witches who maybe were commonly gathering or working together, or families that were known to have like regular, like, yeah, there's a regular witchcraft practice here. These families be are their witches, right? It was common over the centuries for a lot of these families or these communities to raise a son with the intention of sending him off to join the clergy, to actually become a priest or to become a monk or a member of the Catholic Church. And that served a couple of purposes strategically. One, it gave that family a little bit of a window into the activities of the church within their area, right? Because while that son was, of course, loyal to the church, he was a member of the church, excuse me, he would always maintain his loyalty to the family, right?
Loyal to the family.
Exactly. So that was something that popped up in a lot of different areas and different families. It also was beneficial if, say, the church or somebody like you fell under suspicion of witchcraft or older folk magic practices, the Catholic Church didn't approve of, right? Like, you could go to the church and you could say like, oh, well, I mean, we can't be witches. How would that work? We send our sons to you. Our sons work for your, they're part of your clergy. Mm-hmm. Right. So it could be something that could be kind of like a little bit of a could save your butt, kind of was the idea. Right. And again, I want to be really clear. That doesn't mean that every witch family did that. It doesn't mean that that was a common practice all over Italy, but that is something that did occur. Okay. Let's see. You mentioned a few moments ago, deities, and I wanted to talk before going into a lot of that. I want to talk specifically about Mary, because you mentioned Mary specifically. Oh, I'm gonna start putting the dogs in their crates before we record, because they're just way too disruptive.
If we were out there, they would be fine.
No, they were disruptive last week too.
They were. Scout
like
was just trying to get Toby
in
love.
People's faces, and Toby's just as bad. Anyway, so. Mary. So in a lot of Italian folk magic, and in particular branches of witchcraft within Italy, you're going to find a lot of syncretization between the old Roman goddess Diana. And to be very clear, the Italian Diana, the Roman Diana that is looked at by old folk magic practitioners and witches, this is a different Diana than the Hellenistic Diana, but a lot of people are familiar.
Very different.
Okay. Very different. Very, very. Okay. She is I would say almost an entirely separate deity, to be honest, at least in the way that we appeal to her and work with her. Okay. So all y'all working with Diana, we're working with a different Diana. Okay.
She's not a waif.
Yeah. And in no way am I trying to say, if you're someone who works with Diana and you're not working with the old Italian kind of goddess Diana, in no way am I trying to say that your Diana is invalid.
But this is
it's a very different thing.
There's the Hellenistic Diana, which is, I'm a virgin and I'm a huntress. And then there's the Italian Diana, which is, I'm going to chop a priest's head off. That sounds great.
Exactly. The Italian Diana is, a very benevolent kind of a deity, but she will absolutely also fuck you up.
Yes, she will.
She is a
goddess of darkness. She is a dark goddess. She comes from the void.
Well, yes. She's also the goddess of starlight.
Yes.
So not a moon goddess though. Not originally. You're going to find, though, over the years, what happened, particularly once we see the rise of Christianity and Catholicism, particularly throughout Italy, throughout that area of the world, what ultimately ended up happening is the old goddess Diana became syncretized with the Virgin Mary. And you'll even see depictions in Italy to this day. You'll see there are statues, famous statues, that actually sit in Catholic churches and cathedrals. Where you'll see depictions of Mary sitting on a crescent moon with a crown of stars. This is the witch's Diana.
Yeah.
And so you'll find that there's a lot of overlap there. And, I think that's one of the reasons why in more contemporary practice, why people who are coming out of Catholicism, but wanting to connect to cultural, spiritual practices coming out of Italy. Like if they say, like if they have Italian ancestry, right? Mm-hmm. I know everybody that's Catholic is an Italian. I understand that. But if they have those things going on there, you know, they've been Catholic, they have Italian ancestry, they want to connect to that. They have a particular interest in folk magic, witchcraft, these kinds of things. You know, I'm thinking of Frankie.
Yeah.
Talking about this, right? And reconnecting to that, right? For a lot of people, that transition is really easy, because they've grown up praying and revering Mary, the Virgin Mary, you know, the mother of Christ, right? And then they just basically, like now, oh, but she's Diana. And she is Diana. She was Diana first, at least in the cosmology of Italian witchcraft and folk magic. So so it's a pretty easy transition, I think, for a lot of people, or easier than it could be, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Also, Diana's just badass.
For sure. Yeah. So we have an interesting thing in Italian witchcraft and folk magic where we see, I want to be really clear, because there are people that will argue this. Italian witchcraft, specifically Italian witchcraft, is not theistic. And I guess what I mean by that is, while we've talked a whole lot, or we talked several moments now about Diana as the Italian, you know, like the Roman Diana, mm-hmm. you know, the witch's Diana, right? I want to be really clear that that does not mean that all Italian witchcraft is theistic in nature. It is not. To be honest, I think most of the Italian witchcraft you'll find is not theistic. We don't go out of the way to evoke or call in deities. That is a very much a personal choice, mm-hmm. or maybe something that could be a component of particular familial practice or tradition. So that's one of the things I think that also always kind of surprises people a little bit, because I think the contemporary view on witchcraft is like, oh, you have to have a god.
Yeah.
Got to work with the goddess, you know? And yeah, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but that should be a personal choice.
Yeah.
That's a personal choice. Where we have Diana, we also have a counterpart to Diana we see in Lucifer. But I think that Lucifer as the identifier of a divine masculine presence is kind of an interesting one, because neither he or Diana are strictly masculine or feminine.
Yeah.
Like they both within themselves have masculine, what traditionally we would identify as masculine and feminine traits.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool, because you don't really have this harsh duality with the deities mm-hmm. that you see in a lot of like Wicca's really big on that one, right? Where you see, at least traditionally, where you see like, we have our god and we have our goddess, right? We have divine masculine and we have divine feminine, right? And then, and I know that's changed a lot over the years, but originally it was very much like a men and women only, and our gods have to be the same. Divine masculine must have a penis and antlers. Divine feminine has to have big old hanging boobs and a vagina. Right,
essentially.
I'm assuming. Sorry, I was trying to channel my doing my best Gerald Gardner there. I probably failed.
I mean, even if we look at the story of Diana and how Diana came to be, Diana gazed upon herself in the void, in the darkness, upon her reflection, and split herself in two. Lucifer is her twin.
They're basically like just halves of the other,
mm-hmm.
but they're also both complete within themselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Except for she was like, he's super pretty and I want him back inside me now. And then she chases him forever.
Yes, that is actually a really good story. There is in the mythology of the Italian witchcraft deities, Diana and Lucifer, there is a little bit of an issue with incest happening there.
Is it incest?
Well, I think it's incestuous to the extent that they are seen technically as brother and sister.
Yeah, but she created
it. Yeah. So, and of course, we're talking with gods, right? And really, you know, that's just our representation or what we use to embody these energies, yeah. Right? But yeah, but there is the story of how Diana, she became so enamored of the qualities, the aspects of Lucifer that were so beautiful to her, which really, in essence, were basically just a reflection of herself, mm-hmm. right? I'm thinking, boy, that makes her sound like really vain and arrogant, but she is a goddess, right? I'd imagine they have to have a little bit of that going on, right? Anyway, but she was so enamored of Lucifer, her twin brother, that she seduced him And it is through their coupling, through Diana and Lucifer's coupling, that is where we see the rise of Aradia, the demigoddess Aradia. But you've got to be really careful about Aradia. You know, the Gospel of Aradia as put forth by Charles Leland, right? Leland?
Yeah,
right?
Charles Godfrey Leland,
yes. I think is an important book to look at culturally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something I think that should always be included in the study of occult and witchcraft practices coming out of Italy and the Mediterranean. But I also know that a lot of what's in that book is really kind of very, like, that book is very hit and miss.
Yes, it can be. if you believe that he did actually sit down and have a conversation with a witch named Maddalena, then yes. I will say that when my nonna told me the stories of Aradia, Diana, and Lucifer's,
what is this pronunciation?
That's just what my nonna called them. Diana, Lucifer, and Aradia. When my nonna told me them, when she shared those stories with me, they were different, but they're...
You okay?
But they're also going to be different in the sense of... Roxy stepped on her own thing. They are going to be different per family as thing. Well. Yeah, her beeper.
Oh, you have a beeper? Jesus Christ. Hello, 1997.
Hello, Roxy. So each family will have a little bit of a different take on it, but it is pretty close. Like, when I first read the Gospel of Aradia, I was like, this is really similar. So
okay,
is that it? Are we done?
That was really all I wanted to go into, because really to get digging into anything more than that, we have to start going into like specific spirits and practices.
Yeah.
And we really can't talk about that shit.
True.
Good books. I still think The Secret Lives of Women by Karen Crisis,
mm-hmm.
Is an excellent window into the cultural ideas and practices, folk practices specifically. I wouldn't identify that way, or that book is really a good source for witchcraft.
Yeah.
Although a lot of the practices specifically will definitely overlap between folk magic and witchcraft.
Yeah.
But the women, the practices that are showing up in that book, yeah, these were not people that would ever have called themselves witches.
Yeah. Ever.
That's also always, I think, an excellent reference. Oh my God, I'm trying to think of others now. Most of the others really, to be honest, I think kind of really, I don't want to say they fail, but I'm at a point right now where I can't really recommend Grimassi's work for this anymore.
I will recommend Grimassi's work simply for you to read it. If you can read it and understand that it's being filtered through the lens of Alexandrian Wicca.
There you go. Yeah.
Then it is good. It describes particular spirits very well. There is some good historical context on certain families, because, you know, certain families worked with celestial, the stars, certain families focused more with the dead. Mm-hmm. And these were all regional. So it's good. So Italian Witchcraft by Raven Grimassi. Again, remember that it's being filtered through the lens of Alexandrian Wicca.
Yeah.
And actually, Holy Book of Strega by Grimassi is going to have some interesting cultural practices and significances from his family and from what he knows, and from what he learned. Italian folk magic, Rue's Kitchen is really good. I can't remember the author. I think it's Rue Faroon or something. I don't know.
The last thing is Faroon is correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's Rue though.
Yeah. Is really good. There's some cardamancy in there. There's some really good things. Burn a Black Candle is okay.
It's a good, like, I think that's a good, like, intro.
Yeah, it's a good intro. It is very much Italian folk Catholicism. Yeah. Talks about like Three Kings Salts and stuff like that, yeah. Which is really good. And how those things are incorporated. Other than that, I mean, Gospel of Aradia is gonna be good, but that's really it. If you want to learn Italian magic and Italian witchcraft, you got to find yourself an Italian witch, an Italian practitioner. And chances are we're going to ask you, well, are you Italian? And if you're like, no, then we're probably going to be like, got to do a reading on this.
These are still technically closed practices.
Yeah. You can look at some of the historical context around there. You can look up the witch cults of Yanara. Yanara is spelled J-A-N-A-R-A. So hopefully this helps. Hopefully this was interesting for a lot of listeners. I'm going to say we're not going to record in here again because it's really, really dark. And I felt like I couldn't focus.
I like this. I like this vibe in here. Okay, I'll bring the ring light out.
Okay, we'll talk. Anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. I'm not going to do that. You'll be so angry with me.
What?
You'll be so angry with people if I tell them what tomorrow is.
What's tomorrow? Oh, yes, I will. You better shut your mouth. I'll make you eat Roxy. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us for another episode. We will see you next week. Send us your questions and things.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
You gotta click it.
I did click it.
Oh my gosh.
I'm old and I'm technologically infirm.
Thank you.